a physical body, or a non-physical mind, or perhaps a mind trapped inside a body. In the 21st century, the computer network might supercharge the mind-body problem and turn it into a cause for major personal, ideological, and political conflicts. To appreciate the political ramifications of the mind-body problem, let's briefly revisit the history of Christianity. Many of the earliest Christian sects, influenced by Jewish thinking, believed in the Old Testament idea that humans are embodied beings and that the body plays a crucial role in human identity. The book of Genesis said God created humans as physical bodies, and almost all books of the Old Testament assume that humans can exist only as physical bodies. With a few possible exceptions, the Old Testament doesn't mention the possibility of a bodiless existence after death, in heaven or hell. When the ancient Jews fantasized about salvation, they imagined it to mean an earthly kingdom of material bodies. In the time of Jesus, many Jews believed that when the Messiah finally comes, the bodies of the dead would come back to life here on earth. The kingdom of God, established by the Messiah, was supposed to be a material kingdom, with trees and stones and flesh and blood bodies. This was also the view of Jesus himself and the first Christians. Jesus promised his followers that soon the kingdom of God would be built here on earth, and they would inhabit it in their material bodies. When Jesus died without fulfilling his promise, his early followers came to believe that he was resurrected in the flesh, and that when the kingdom of God finally materialized on earth, they too would be resurrected in the flesh. The church father, Tertullian, 160 to 240 CE, wrote that the flesh is the very condition on which salvation hinges. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church, citing the doctrines adopted at the Second Council of Lyon in 1274, states, "We believe in God who is creator of the flesh. We believe in the Word made flesh in order to redeem the flesh. We believe in the resurrection of the flesh, the fulfillment of both the creation and the redemption of the flesh. We believe in the true resurrection of this flesh that we now possess." Despite such seemingly unequivocal statements, we saw that St. Paul already had his doubts about the flesh, and by the 4th century CE, under Greek, Manichaean, and Persian influences, some Christians had drifted toward a dualistic approach. They came to think of humans as consisting of a good immaterial soul trapped inside an evil material body. They didn't fantasize about being resurrected in the flesh, just the opposite. Having been released by death from its abominable material prison, why would the pure soul ever want to get back in? Christians accordingly began to believe that after death, the soul is liberated from the body and exists forever in an immaterial place completely beyond the physical realm, which is the standard belief among Christians today, notwithstanding what Tertullian and the Second Council of Lyon said. But Christianity couldn't completely abandon the old Jewish view that humans are embodied beings. After all, Christ appeared on earth in the flesh. His body was nailed to the cross, on which he experienced excruciating pain. For 2,000 years, Christian sects therefore fought each other, sometimes with words, sometimes with swords, over the exact relations between soul and body. The fiercest arguments focused on Christ's own body. Was he material? Was he purely spiritual? Did he perhaps have a non-binary nature, being both human and divine at the same time? The different approaches to the mind-body problem influenced how people treated their own bodies. Saints, hermits, and monks made breathtaking experiments in pushing the human body to its limits. Just as Christ allowed his body to be tortured on the cross, so these athletes of Christ allowed lions and bears to rip them apart while their souls rejoiced in divine ecstasy. They wore hair shirts, fasted for weeks, or stood for years on a pillar, like the famous Simeon who allegedly stood for about 40 years on top of a pillar near Aleppo. Other Christians took the opposite approach, believing that the body didn't matter at all. The only thing that mattered was faith. This idea was taken to extremes by Protestants like Martin Luther, who formulated the doctrine of sola fide, only faith. After living as a monk for about 10 years, fasting and torturing his body in various ways, Luther despaired of these bodily exercises. He reasoned that no bodily self-torments could force God to redeem him. Indeed, thinking he could win his own salvation by torturing his body was the sin of pride. Luther therefore disrobed, married a former nun, and told his followers that to be good Christians, the only thing they needed was to have complete faith in Christ. These ancient theological debates about mind and body may seem utterly irrelevant to the AI revolution, but they have in fact been resurrected by 21st century technologies. What is the relationship between our physical body and our online identities and avatars? What is the relation between the offline world and cyberspace? Suppose I spend most of my waking hours sitting in my room in front of a screen, playing online games, forming virtual relationships, and even working remotely. I hardly venture out even to eat. I just order takeout. If you are like ancient Jews and the first Christians, you would pity me and conclude I must be living in a delusion, losing touch with the reality of physical spaces and flesh and blood bodies. But if your thinking is closer to that of Luther and many later Christians, you might think I am liberated. By shifting most of my activities and relationships online, I have released myself from the limited organic world of debilitating gravity and corrupt bodies, and can enjoy the unlimited possibilities of a digital world, which is potentially liberated from the laws of biology and even physics. I am free to roam a much vaster and more exciting space and to explore new aspects of my identity. An increasingly important question is, can people adopt any virtual identity they like, or should their identity be constrained by their biological body? If we follow the Lutheran position of sola fide, the biological body isn't of much importance. To adopt a certain online identity, the only thing that matters is what you believe. This debate can have far-reaching consequences, not just for human identity, but for our attitude to the world as a whole. A society that understands identities in terms of biological bodies should also care more about material infrastructure like sewage pipes and about the ecosystem that sustains our bodies. It will see the online world as an auxiliary of the offline world that can serve various useful purposes, but can never become the central arena of our lives. Its aim would be to create an ideal physical and biological realm, the kingdom of God on earth. In contrast, a society that downplays biological bodies and focuses on online identities may well seek to create an immersive kingdom of God in cyberspace, while discounting the fate of mere material things like sewage pipes and rainforests. This debate could shape attitudes not only toward organisms, but also toward digital entities. As long as society defines identity by focusing on physical bodies, it is unlikely to view AIs as persons. But if society gives less importance to physical bodies, then even AIs that lack any corporeal manifestations may be accepted as legal persons, enjoying various rights. Throughout history, diverse cultures have given diverse answers to the mind-body problem. A 21st century controversy about the mind-body problem could result in cultural and political splits more consequential even than the split between Jews and Christians or between Catholics and Protestants. What happens, for example, if the American sphere discounts the body, defines humans by their online identity, recognizes AIs as persons, and downplays the importance of the ecosystem, whereas the Chinese sphere adopts opposite positions? Current disagreements about violations of human rights or adherence to ecological standards will look minuscule in comparison. The 30 Years' War, arguably the most devastating war in European history, was fought at least in part because Catholics and Protestants couldn't agree on doctrines like sola fide and on whether Christ was divine, human, or non-binary. Might future conflicts start because of an argument about AI rights and the non-binary nature of avatars? As noted, these are all wild speculations, and in all likelihood, actual cultures and ideologies will develop in different, and perhaps even wilder, directions. But it is probable that within a few decades, the computer network will cultivate new human and non-human identities that make little sense to us. And if the world will be divided into two rival digital cocoons, the identities of entities in one cocoon might be unintelligible to the inhabitants of the other. From Cold War to Hot War. While China and the United States are currently the frontrunners in the AI race, they are not alone. Other countries or blocs, such as the EU, India, Brazil, and Russia, may try to create their own digital spheres, each influenced by different political, cultural, and religious traditions. Instead of being divided between just two global empires, the world might be divided among a dozen empires. It is unclear whether this will somewhat alleviate or only exacerbate the imperial competition. The more the new empires compete against one another, the greater the danger of armed conflict. The Cold War between the United States and the USSR never escalated into a direct military confrontation, largely thanks to the doctrine of mutually assured destruction. But the danger of escalation in the age of AI is bigger, because cyber warfare is inherently different from nuclear warfare. First, cyber weapons are much more versatile than nuclear bombs. Cyber weapons can bring down a country's electric grid, but they can also be used to destroy a secret research facility, jam an enemy's sensor, inflame a political scandal, manipulate elections, or hack a single smartphone. And they can do all that stealthily. They don't announce their presence with a mushroom cloud and a storm of fire, nor do they leave a visible trail from launchpad to target. Consequently, at times it is hard to know if an attack even occurred or who launched it. If a database is hacked or sensitive equipment is destroyed, it's hard to be sure whom to blame. The temptation to start a limited cyber war is therefore big, and so is the temptation to escalate it. Rival countries like Israel and Iran, or the United States and Russia, have been trading cyber blows for years in an undeclared but escalating war. This is becoming the new global norm, amplifying international tensions and pushing countries to cross one red line after another. A second crucial difference concerns predictability. The Cold War was like a hyper-rational chess game, and the certainty of destruction in the event of nuclear conflict was so great that the desire to start a war was correspondingly small. Cyber warfare lacks this certainty. Nobody knows for sure where each side has planted its logic bombs, Trojan horses, and malware. Nobody can be certain whether their own weapons would actually work when called upon. Would Chinese missiles fire when the order is given? Or perhaps the Americans have hacked them or the chain of command? Would American aircraft carriers function as expected? Or would they perhaps shut down mysteriously or sail around in circles? Such uncertainty undermines the doctrine of mutually assured destruction. One side might convince itself, rightly or wrongly, that it can launch a successful first strike and avoid massive retaliation. Even worse, if one side thinks it has such an opportunity, the temptation to launch a first strike could become irresistible, because one never knows how long the window of opportunity will remain open. Game theory posits that the most dangerous situation in an arms race is when one side feels it has an advantage, but that this advantage is slipping away. Even if humanity avoids the worst-case scenario of global war, the rise of new digital empires could still endanger the freedom and prosperity of billions of people. The industrial empires of the 19th and 20th centuries exploited and repressed their colonies, and it would be foolhardy to expect the new digital empires to behave much better. Moreover, as noted earlier, if the world is divided into rival empires, humanity is unlikely to cooperate effectively to overcome the ecological crisis or to regulate AI and other disruptive technologies like bioengineering. The global bond. Of course, no matter whether the world is divided between a few digital empires, remains a more diverse community of 200 nation-states, or is split along altogether different and unforeseen lines, cooperation is always an option. Among humans, the precondition for cooperation isn't similarity. It is the ability to exchange information. As long as we are able to converse, we might find some shared story that can bring us closer. This, after all, is what made Homo sapiens the dominant species on the planet. Just as different and even rival families can cooperate within a tribal network, and competing tribes can cooperate within a national network, so opposing nations and empires can cooperate within a global network. The stories that make such cooperation possible do not eliminate our differences. Rather, they enable us to identify shared experiences and interests which offer a common framework for thought and action. A large part of what nevertheless makes global cooperation difficult is the misguided notion that it requires abolishing all cultural, social, and political differences. Populist politicians often argue that if the international community agrees on a common story and on universal norms and values, this will destroy the independence and unique traditions of their own nation. This position was unabashedly distilled in 2015 by Marine Le Pen, leader of France's National Front Party, in an election speech in which she declared, "We have entered a new two-partyism. A two-partyism between two mutually exclusive conceptions that will from now on structure our political life. The cleavage no longer separates left and right, but globalists and patriots." In August 2020, President Trump described his guiding ethos thus: "We have rejected globalism and embraced patriotism." Luckily, this binary position is mistaken in its basic assumption. Global cooperation and patriotism are not mutually exclusive. For patriotism isn't about hating foreigners, it is about loving our compatriots. And there are many situations when, in order to take care of our compatriots, we need to cooperate with foreigners. COVID-19 provided us with one obvious example. Pandemics are global events, and without global cooperation, it is hard to contain them, let alone prevent them. When the new virus or a mutant pathogen appears in one country, it puts all other countries in danger. Conversely, the biggest advantage of humans over pathogens is that we can cooperate in ways that pathogens cannot. Doctors in Germany and Brazil can alert one another to new dangers, give one another good advice, and work together to discover better treatments. If German scientists invent a vaccine against some new disease, how should Brazilians react to this German achievement? One option is to reject the foreign vaccine and wait until Brazilian scientists develop a Brazilian vaccine. That, however, would be not just foolish, it would be anti-patriotic. Brazilian patriots should want to use any available vaccine to help their compatriots, no matter where the vaccine was developed. In this situation, cooperating with foreigners is the patriotic thing to do. The threat of losing control of AIs is an analogous situation, in which patriotism and global cooperation must go together. An out-of-control AI, just like an out-of-control virus, puts in danger humans in every nation. No human collective, whether a tribe, a nation, or the entire species, stands to benefit from letting power shift from humans to algorithms. Contrary to what populists argue, globalism doesn't mean establishing a global empire, abandoning national loyalties, or opening borders to unlimited immigration. In fact, global cooperation means two far more modest things. First, a commitment to some global rules. These rules don't deny the uniqueness of each nation and the loyalty people should owe their nation. They just regulate the relations between nations. A good model is the World Cup. The World Cup is a competition between nations, and people often show fierce loyalty to their national team. At the same time, the World Cup is an amazing display of global agreement. Brazil cannot play football against Germany unless Brazilians and Germans first agree on the same set of rules for the game. That's globalism in action. The second principle of globalism is that sometimes, not always, but sometimes, it is necessary to prioritize the long-term interests of all humans over the short-term interests of a few. For example, in the World Cup, all national teams agree not to use performance-enhancing drugs, because everybody realizes that if they go down that path, the World Cup would eventually devolve into a competition between biochemists. In other fields where technology is a game-changer, we should similarly strive to balance national and global interests. Nations will obviously continue to compete in the development of new technology, but sometimes they should agree to limit the development and deployment of dangerous technologies, like autonomous weapons and manipulative algorithms, not purely out of altruism, but for their own self-preservation. The human choice. Forging and keeping international agreements on AI will require major changes in the way the international system functions. While we have experience in regulating dangerous technologies like nuclear and biological weapons, the regulation of AI will demand unprecedented levels of trust and self-discipline for two reasons. First, it is easier to hide an illicit AI lab than an illicit nuclear reactor. Second, AIs have a lot more dual civilian-military usages than nuclear bombs. Consequently, despite signing an agreement that bans autonomous weapons systems, a country could build such weapons secretly or camouflage them as civilian products. For example, it might develop fully autonomous drones for delivering mail and spraying fields with pesticides that, with a few minor modifications, could also deliver bombs and spray people with poison. Consequently, governments and corporations will find it more difficult to trust that their rivals are really abiding by the agreed regulations, and to withstand the temptation to themselves waive the rules. Can humans develop the necessary levels of trust and self-discipline? Do changes like those have any precedent in history? Many people are skeptical of the human capacity to change, and in particular, of the human ability to renounce violence and forge stronger global bonds. For example, realist thinkers like Hans Morgenthau and John Mearsheimer have argued that an all-out competition for power is the inescapable condition of the international system. Mearsheimer explains that his theory sees great powers as concerned mainly with figuring out how to survive in a world where there is no agency to protect them from each other, and that they quickly realize that power is the key to their survival. Mearsheimer then asks how much power states want, and answers that all states want as much power as they can get, because the international system creates powerful incentives for states to look for opportunities to gain power at the expense of rivals. He concludes, a state's ultimate goal is to be the hegemon in the system. This grim view of international relations is akin to the populist and Marxist views of human relations, in that they all see humans as interested only in power. And they are all founded upon a deeper philosophical theory of human nature, which the primatologist Franz de Waal termed veneer theory. It argues that at heart, humans are Stone Age hunters who cannot but see the world as a jungle where the strong prey upon the weak, and where might makes right. For millennia, the theory goes, humans have tried to camouflage this unchanging reality under a thin and mutable veneer of myths and rituals, but we have never really broken free from the law of the jungle. Indeed, our myths and rituals are themselves a weapon used by the jungle's top dogs to deceive and trap their inferiors. Those who don't realize this are dangerously naive and will fall prey to some ruthless predator. There are reasons to think, however, that realists like Mearsheimer have a selective view of historical reality and that the law of the jungle is itself a myth. As De Waal and many other biologists documented in numerous studies, real jungles, unlike the one in our imagination, are full of cooperation, symbiosis, and altruism displayed by countless animals, plants, fungi, and even bacteria. 80% of all land plants, for example, rely on symbiotic relationships with fungi, and almost 90% of vascular plant families enjoy symbiotic relationships with microorganisms. If organisms in the rainforests of Amazonia, Africa, or India abandoned cooperation in favor of an all-out competition for hegemony, the rainforests and all their inhabitants would quickly die. That's the law of the jungle. As for Stone Age humans, they were gatherers as well as hunters, and there is no firm evidence that they had irrepressible warlike tendencies. While there are plenty of speculations, the first unambiguous evidence for organized warfare appears in the archaeological record only about 13,000 years ago, at the site of Jebel Sahaba in the Nile Valley. Even after that date, the record of war is variable rather than constant. Some periods were exceptionally violent, whereas others were relatively peaceful. The clearest pattern we observe in the long-term history of humanity isn't the constancy of conflict, but rather the increasing scale of cooperation. 100,000 years ago, sapiens could cooperate only at the level of bands. Over the millennia, we have found ways to create communities of strangers, first on the level of tribes, and eventually on the level of religions, trade networks, and states. Realists should note that states are not the fundamental particles of human reality, but rather the product of arduous processes of building trust and cooperation. If humans were interested only in power, they could never have created states in the first place. Sure, conflicts have always remained a possibility, both between and within states, but they have never been an inescapable destiny. War's intensity depends not on an immutable human nature, but on shifting technological, economic, and cultural factors. As these factors change, so does war, as was clearly demonstrated in the post-1945 era. During that period, the development of nuclear technology greatly increased the potential price of war. From the 1950s onward, it became clear to the superpowers that even if they could somehow win an all-out nuclear exchange, their victory would likely be a suicidal achievement, involving the sacrifice of most of their population. Simultaneously, the ongoing shift from a material-based economy to a knowledge-based economy decreased the potential gains of war. While it has remained feasible to conquer rice paddies and gold mines, by the late 20th century, these were no longer the main sources of economic wealth. The new leading industries, like the semiconductor sector, came to be based on technical skills and organizational know-how that could not be acquired by military conquest. Accordingly, some of the greatest economic miracles of the post-1945 era were achieved by the defeated powers of Germany, Italy, and Japan, and by countries like Sweden and Singapore that eschewed military conflicts and imperial conquests. Finally, the second half of the 20th century also witnessed a profound cultural transformation, with the decline of age-old militaristic ideals. Artists increasingly focused on depicting the senseless horrors of combat rather than on glorifying its architects, and politicians came to power dreaming more of domestic reforms than of foreign conquests. Due to these technological, economic, and cultural changes, in the decades following the end of World War II, most governments stopped seeing wars of aggression as an appealing tool to advance their interests, and most nations stopped fantasizing about conquering and destroying their neighbors. While civil wars and insurgencies have remained commonplace, the post-1945 world has seen a significant decline in full-scale wars between states, and most notably in direct armed conflicts between great powers. Numerous statistics attest to the decline of war in this post-1945 era, but perhaps the clearest evidence is found in state budgets. For most of recorded history, the military was the number one item on the budget of every empire, sultanate, kingdom, and republic. Governments spent little on healthcare and education because most of their resources were consumed by paying soldiers, constructing walls, and building warships. When the bureaucrat Chen Zhang examined the annual budget of the Chinese Song Dynasty for the year 1065, he found that out of 60 million Minchan, currency unit, 50 million, 83%, were consumed by the military. Another official, Kai Zhang, wrote, "If we split all the property under heaven into six shares, five shares are spent on the military, and one share is spent on temple offerings and state expenses. How can the country not be poor and the people not in difficulty?" The same situation prevailed in many other polities, from ancient times to the modern era. The Roman Empire spent about 50 to 75% of its budget on the military, and the figure was about 60% in the late 17th century Ottoman Empire. Between 1685 and 1813, the share of the military in British government expenditure averaged 75%. In France, military expenditure between 1630 and 1659 varied between 89% and 93% of the budget, remained above 30% for much of the 18th century, and dropped to a low of 25% in 1788, only due to the financial crisis that led to the French Revolution. In Prussia, from 1711 to 1800, the military share of the budget never fell below 75%, and occasionally reached as high as 91%. During the relatively peaceful years of 1870 to 1913, the military ate up an average of 30% of the state budgets of the major powers of Europe, as well as Japan and the United States, while smaller powers like Sweden were spending even more. When war broke out in 1914, military budgets skyrocketed. During their involvement in World War I, French military expenditure averaged 77% of the budget. In Germany, it was 91%. In Russia, 48%, in the UK, 49%, and in the United States, 47%. During World War II, the UK figure rose to 69% and the US figure to 71%. Even during the detente years of the 1970s, Soviet military expenditure still amounted to 32.5% of the budget. State budgets in more recent decades make for far more hopeful reading material than any pacifist tract ever composed. In the early 21st century, the worldwide average government expenditure on the military has been only around 7% of the budget, and even the dominant superpower of the United States spent only around 13% of its annual budget to maintain its military hegemony. Since most people no longer lived in terror of external invasion, governments could invest far more money in welfare, education, and healthcare. Worldwide average expenditure on healthcare in the early 21st century has been about 10% of the government budget, or about 1.4 times the defense budget. For many people in the 2010s, the fact that the healthcare budget was bigger than the military budget was unremarkable. But it was the result of a major change in human behavior, and one that would have sounded impossible to most previous generations. The decline of war didn't result from a divine miracle or from a metamorphosis in the laws of nature. It resulted from humans changing their own laws, myths, and institutions, and making better decisions. Unfortunately, the fact that this change has stemmed from human choice also means that it is reversible. Technology, economics, and culture are ever-changing. In the early 2020s, more leaders are again dreaming of martial glory, armed conflicts are on the rise, and military budgets are increasing. A critical threshold was crossed in early 2022. Russia had already destabilized the global order by mounting a limited invasion of Ukraine in 2014 and occupying Crimea and other regions in eastern Ukraine. But on February 24, 2022, Vladimir Putin launched an all-out assault aimed to conquer the whole of Ukraine and extinguish Ukrainian nationhood. To prepare and sustain this attack, Russia increased its military budget far beyond the global average of 7%. Exact figures are difficult to determine because many aspects of the Russian military budget are shrouded in secrecy. But the best estimates put the figure somewhere in the vicinity of 30%, and it may even be higher. The Russian onslaught, in turn, has forced not only Ukraine, but also many other European nations to increase their own military budgets. The re-emergence of militaristic cultures in places like Russia, and the development of unprecedented cyber weapons and autonomous armaments throughout the world, could result in a new era of war, worse than anything we have seen before. The decisions leaders like Putin make on matters of war and peace are shaped by their understanding of history, which means that just as overly optimistic views of history could be dangerous illusions, overly pessimistic views could become destructive, self-fulfilling prophecies. Prior to his all-out 2022 attack on Ukraine, Putin had often expressed his historical conviction that Russia is trapped in an endless struggle with foreign enemies, and that the Ukrainian nation is a fabrication by these enemies. In June 2021, he published a 5,300-word essay titled On the Historical Unity of Russians and Ukrainians, in which he denied the existence of Ukraine as a nation and argued that foreign powers have repeatedly tried to weaken Russia by fostering Ukrainian separatism. While professional historians reject these claims, Putin seems to genuinely believe in this historical narrative. Putin's historical convictions led him in 2022 to prioritize the conquest of Ukraine over other policy goals, such as providing Russian citizens with better healthcare or spearheading a global initiative to regulate AI. If leaders like Putin believe that humanity is trapped in an unforgiving dog-eat-dog world, that no profound change is possible in this sorry state of affairs, and that the relative peace of the late 20th century and early 21st century was an illusion, then the only choice remaining is whether to play the part of predator or prey. Given such a choice, most leaders would prefer to go down in history as predators and add their names to the grim list of conquerors that unfortunate pupils are condemned to memorize for their history exams. These leaders should be reminded, however, that in the era of AI, the alpha predator is likely to be AI. Perhaps, though, we have more choices available to us. I cannot predict what decisions people will make in the coming years, but as a historian, I do believe in the possibility of change. One of the chief lessons of history is that many of the things that we consider natural and eternal are, in fact, man-made and mutable. Accepting that conflict is not inevitable, however, should not make us complacent. Just the opposite. It places a heavy responsibility on all of us to make good choices. It implies that if human civilization is consumed by conflict, we cannot blame it on any law of nature or any alien technology. It also implies that if we make the effort, we can create a better world. This isn't naivete, it's realism. Every old thing was once new. The only constant of history is change. Epilogue. In late 2016, A few months after AlphaGo defeated Lee Sedol and as Facebook algorithms were stoking dangerous racist sentiments in Myanmar, I published Homo Deus. Though my academic training had been in medieval and early modern military history, and though I have no background in the technical aspects of computer science, I suddenly found myself, post-publication, with the reputation of an AI expert. This opened the doors to the offices of scientists, entrepreneurs, and world leaders interested in AI, and afforded me a fascinating, privileged look into the complex dynamics of the AI revolution. It turned out that my previous experience researching topics such as English strategy in the Hundred Years' War and studying paintings from the Thirty Years' War wasn't entirely unrelated to this new field. In fact, it gave me a rather unique historical perspective on the events unfolding rapidly in AI labs, corporate offices, military headquarters, and presidential palaces. Over the past 8 years, I have had numerous public and private discussions about AI, particularly about the dangers it poses. And with each passing year, the tone has become more urgent. Conversations that in 2016 felt like idle philosophical speculations about a distant future had, by 2024, acquired the focused intensity of an emergency room. I am neither a politician nor a business person, and have little talent for what these vocations demand. But I do believe that an understanding of history can be useful in gaining a better grasp of present-day technological, economic, and cultural developments, and, more urgently, in changing our political priorities. Politics is largely a matter of priorities. Should we cut the healthcare budget and spend more on defense? Is our more pressing security threat terrorism or climate change? Do we focus on regaining a lost patch of ancestral territory or concentrate on creating a common economic zone with the neighbors? Priorities determine how citizens vote, what business people are concerned about, and how politicians try to make a name for themselves. And priorities are often shaped by our understanding of history. While so-called realists dismiss historical narratives as propaganda ploys deployed to advance state interests, in fact, it is these narratives that define state interests in the first place. As we saw in our discussion of Clausewitz's theory of war, there is no rational way to define ultimate goals. The state interests of Russia, Israel, Myanmar, or any other country can never be deduced from some mathematical or physical equation. They are always the supposed moral of a historical narrative. It is therefore hardly surprising that politicians all over the world spend a lot of time and effort recounting historical narratives. The example of Vladimir Putin I just mentioned is hardly exceptional in this respect. In 2005, the UN Secretary General, Kofi Annan, had his first meeting with General Than Shwe, then the dictator of Myanmar. Annan was advised to speak first, so as to prevent the general from monopolizing the conversation, which was meant to last only 20 minutes. But Than Shwe struck first and held forth for nearly an hour on the history of Myanmar, hardly giving the UN Secretary General any chance to speak. In May 2011, the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, did something similar in the White House when he met the US President, Barack Obama. After Obama's brief introductory remarks, Netanyahu subjected the president to a long lecture about the history of Israel and the Jewish people, treating Obama as if he were his student. Cynics might argue that Than Shwe and Netanyahu hardly cared about the facts of history, and were deliberately distorting them in order to achieve some political goal. But these political goals were themselves the product of deeply held convictions about history. In my own conversations on AI with politicians, as well as tech entrepreneurs, history has often emerged as a central theme. Some of my interlocutors painted a rosy picture of history and were accordingly enthusiastic about AI. They argued that more information has always meant more knowledge, and that by increasing our knowledge, every previous information revolution has greatly benefited humankind. Didn't the print revolution lead to the scientific revolution? Didn't newspapers and radio lead to the rise of modern democracy? The same, they said, would happen with AI. Others had a dimmer perspective, but nevertheless expressed hope that humankind will somehow muddle through the AI revolution, just as we muddled through the Industrial Revolution. Neither view offered me much solace. For reasons explained in previous chapters, I find such historical comparisons to the print revolution and the Industrial Revolution distressing, especially coming from people in positions of power whose historical vision is informing the decisions that shape our future. These historical comparisons underestimate both the unprecedented nature of the AI revolution and the negative aspects of previous revolutions. The immediate results of the print revolution included witch hunts and religious wars alongside scientific discoveries, while newspapers and radio were exploited by totalitarian regimes as well as by democracies. As for the Industrial Revolution, adapting to it involved catastrophic experiments such as imperialism and Nazism. If the AI revolution leads us to similar kinds of experiments, can we really be certain we will muddle through again? My goal with this book is to provide a more accurate historical perspective on the AI revolution. This revolution is still in its infancy, and it is notoriously difficult to understand momentous developments in real time. It is hard, even now, to assess the meaning of events in the 2010s like AlphaGo's victory or Facebook's involvement in the anti-Rohingya campaign. The meaning of events of the early 2020s is even more obscure. Yet, by expanding our horizons to look at how information networks developed over thousands of years, I believe it is possible to gain some insight on what we're living through today. One lesson is that the invention of new information technology is always a catalyst for major historical changes, because the most important role of information is to weave new networks rather than represent pre-existing realities. By recording tax payments, clay tablets in ancient Mesopotamia helped forge the first city-states. By canonizing prophetic visions, holy books spread new kinds of religions. By swiftly disseminating the words of presidents and citizens, newspapers and telegraphs open the door to both large-scale democracy and large-scale totalitarianism. The information thus recorded and distributed was sometimes true, often false, but it invariably created new connections between larger numbers of people. We are used to giving political, ideological, and economic interpretations to historical revolutions, such as the rise of the first Mesopotamian city-states, the spread of Christianity, the American Revolution, and the Bolshevik Revolution. But to gain a deeper understanding, we should also view them as revolutions in the way information flows. Christianity was obviously different from Greek polytheism in many of its myths and rites, yet it was also different in the importance it gave to a single holy book and the institution entrusted with interpreting it. Consequently, whereas each temple of Zeus was a separate entity, each Christian church became a node in a unified network. Information flowed differently among the followers of Christ than among the worshippers of Zeus. Similarly, Stalin's USSR was a different kind of information network from Peter the Great's empire. Stalin enacted many unprecedented economic policies, but what enabled him to do it is that he headed a totalitarian network in which the center accumulated enough information to micromanage the lives of hundreds of millions of people. Technology is rarely deterministic, and the same technology can be used in very different ways. But without the invention of technologies like the book and the telegraph, the Christian church and the Stalinist apparatus would never have been possible. This historical lesson should strongly encourage us to pay more attention to the AI revolution in our current political debates. The invention of AI is potentially more momentous than the invention of the telegraph, the printing press, or even writing, because AI is the first tool that is capable of making decisions and generating ideas by itself. Whereas printing presses and parchment scrolls offered new means for connecting people, AIs are full-fledged members in our information networks. In coming years, all networks, from armies to religions, will gain millions of new AI members, which will process data differently than humans do. These new members will make alien decisions and generate alien ideas, that is, decisions and ideas that are unlikely to occur to humans. The addition of many alien agents is bound to change the shape of armies, religions, markets, and nations. Entire political, economic, and social systems might collapse, and new ones will take their place. That's why AI should be a matter of utmost urgency, even to people who don't care about technology and who think the most important political questions concern the survival of democracy or the fair distribution of wealth. This book has juxtaposed the discussion of AI with the discussion of sacred canons like the Bible, because we are now at the critical moment of AI canonization. When church fathers like Bishop Athanasius decided to include 1 Timothy in the biblical dataset, while excluding the Acts of Paul and Thecla, they shaped the world for millennia. Billions of Christians down to the 21st century have formed their views of the world based on the misogynist ideas of 1 Timothy rather than on the more tolerant attitude of Thecla. Even today, it is difficult to reverse course, because the church fathers chose not to include any self-correcting mechanisms in the Bible. The present-day equivalents of Bishop Athanasius are the engineers who write the initial code for AI and who choose the dataset on which the baby AI is trained. As AI grows in power and authority, and perhaps becomes a self-interpreting holy book, so the decisions made by present-day engineers could reverberate down the ages. Studying history does more than just emphasize the importance of the AI revolution and of our decisions regarding AI. It also cautions us against too common but misleading approaches to information networks and information revolutions. On the one hand, we should beware of an overly naive and optimistic view. Information isn't truth. Its main task is to connect rather than represent, and information networks throughout history have often privileged order over truth. Tax records, holy books, political manifestos, and secret police files can be extremely efficient in creating powerful states and churches, which hold a distorted view of the world and are prone to abuse their power. More information, ironically, can sometimes result in more witch hunts. There is no reason to expect that AI would necessarily break the pattern and privilege truth. AI is not infallible. What little historical perspective we have gained from the alarming events in Myanmar, Brazil, and elsewhere over the past decade indicates that in the absence of strong self-correcting mechanisms, AIs are more than capable of promoting distorted worldviews, enabling egregious abuses of power, and instigating terrifying new witch hunts. On the other hand, we should also beware of swinging too far in the other direction and adopting an overly cynical view. Populists tell us that power is the only reality, that all human interactions are power struggles, and that information is merely a weapon we use to vanquish our enemies. This has never been the case, and there is no reason to think that AI will make it so in the future. While many information networks do privilege order over truth, no network can survive if it ignores truth completely. As for individual humans, we tend to be genuinely interested in truth rather than only in power. Even institutions like the Spanish Inquisition have had conscientious, truth-seeking members like Alonso de Salazar Frias, who, instead of sending innocent people to their deaths, risked his life to remind us that witches are just intersubjective fictions. Most people don't view themselves as one-dimensional creatures obsessed solely with power. Why, then, hold such a view about everyone else? Refusing to reduce all human interactions to a zero-sum power struggle is crucial not just for gaining a fuller, more nuanced understanding of the past, but also for having a more hopeful and constructive attitude about our future. If power were the only reality, then the only way to resolve conflicts would be through violence. Both populists and Marxists believe that people's views are determined by their privileges, and that to change people's views it is necessary to first take away their privileges, which usually requires force. However, since humans are interested in truth, there is a chance to resolve at least some conflicts peacefully by talking to one another, acknowledging mistakes, embracing new ideas, and revising the stories we believe. That is the basic assumption of democratic networks and of scientific institutions. It has also been the basic motivation behind writing this book. Extinction of the smartest. Let's return now to the question I posed at the beginning of this book. If we are so wise, why are we so self-destructive? We are at one and the same time both the smartest and the stupidest animals on Earth. We are so smart that we can produce nuclear missiles and super-intelligent algorithms. And we are so stupid that we go ahead producing these things even though we're not sure we can control them, and failing to do so could destroy us. Why do we do it? Does something in our nature compel us to go down the path of self-destruction? This book has argued that the fault isn't with our nature, but with our information networks. Due to the privileging of order over truth, human information networks have often produced a lot of power, but little wisdom. For example, Nazi Germany created a highly efficient military machine and placed it at the service of an insane mythology. The result was misery on an enormous scale, the death of tens of millions of people, and eventually the destruction of Nazi Germany too. Of course, power is not in itself bad. When used wisely, it can be an instrument of benevolence. Modern civilization, for example, has acquired the power to prevent famines, contain epidemics, and mitigate natural disasters such as hurricanes and earthquakes. In general, the acquisition of power allows a network to deal more effectively with threats coming from outside, but simultaneously increases the dangers that the network poses to itself. It is particularly noteworthy that as a network becomes more powerful, imaginary terrors that exist only in the stories the network itself invents become potentially more dangerous than natural disasters. A modern state faced with drought or excessive rains can usually prevent this natural disaster from causing mass starvation among its citizens. But a modern state gripped by a man-made fantasy is capable of instigating man-made famines on an enormous scale, as happened in the USSR in the early 1930s. Accordingly, as a network becomes more powerful, its self-correcting mechanisms become more vital. If a Stone Age tribe or a Bronze Age city-state was incapable of identifying and correcting its own mistakes, the potential damage was limited. At most, one city was destroyed, and the survivors tried again elsewhere. Even if the ruler of an Iron Age empire, such as Tiberius or Nero, was gripped by paranoia or psychosis, the consequences were seldom catastrophic. The Roman Empire endured for centuries despite its fair share of mad emperors, and its eventual collapse did not bring about the end of human civilization. But if a Silicon Age superpower has weak or non-existent self-correcting mechanisms, it could very well endanger the survival of our species, and countless other life forms too. In the era of AI, the whole of humankind finds itself in an analogous situation to Tiberius in his Capri villa. We command immense power and enjoy rare luxuries, but we are easily manipulated by our own creations. And by the time we wake up to the danger, it might be too late. Unfortunately, despite the importance of self-correcting mechanisms for the long-term welfare of humanity, politicians might be tempted to weaken them. As we have seen throughout the book, though neutralizing self-correcting mechanisms has many downsides, it can nevertheless be a winning political strategy. It could deliver immense power into the hands of a 21st century Stalin, and it would be foolhardy to assume that an AI-enhanced totalitarian regime would necessarily self-destruct before it could wreak havoc on human civilization. Just as the law of the jungle is a myth, so also is the idea that the arc of history bends toward justice. History is a radically open arc, one that can bend in many directions and reach very different destinations. Even if Homo sapiens destroys itself, the universe will keep going about its business as usual. It took 4 billion years for terrestrial evolution to produce a civilization of highly intelligent apes. If we are gone, and it takes evolution another 100 million years to produce a civilization of highly intelligent rats, it will. The universe is patient. There is, though, an even worse scenario. As far as we know today, apes, rats, and the other organic animals of planet Earth may be the only conscious entities in the entire universe. We have now created a non-conscious but very powerful alien intelligence. If we mishandle it, AI might extinguish not only the human dominion on Earth, but the light of consciousness itself, turning the universe into a realm of utter darkness. It is our responsibility to prevent this. The good news is that if we eschew complacency and despair, we are capable of creating balanced information networks that will keep their own power in check. Doing so is not a matter of inventing another miracle technology or landing upon some brilliant idea that has somehow escaped all previous generations. Rather, to create wiser networks, we must abandon both the naive and the populist views of information, put aside our fantasies of infallibility, and commit ourselves to the hard and rather mundane work of building institutions with strong self-correcting mechanisms. That is perhaps the most important takeaway this book has to offer. This wisdom is much older than human history. It is elemental, the foundation of organic life. The first organisms weren't created by some infallible genius or god. They emerged through an intricate process of trial and error. Over 4 billion years, ever more complex mechanisms of mutation and self-correction led to the evolution of trees, dinosaurs, jungles, and eventually humans. Now we have summoned an alien inorganic intelligence that could escape our control and put in danger not just our own species, but countless other life forms. The decisions we all make in the coming years will determine whether summoning this alien intelligence proves to be a terminal error or the beginning of a hopeful new chapter in the evolution of life. We hope you have enjoyed this Penguin Audio production of Nexus, A Brief History of Information Networks from the Stone Age to AI, by Yuval Noah Harari, read by Videesh Atavle. For more Penguin Audio productions, visit us at penguin.co.uk/audio. Copyright and recording, Penguin Random House LLC, 2024. Text copyright, Yuval Noah Harari, 2024. This program was directed by Tara Thomas. Executive producer, Kelly Gilday. Associate producer, Juan Garcia Ticolat. Edited by JSR Post LLC. All rights reserved. The moral rights of the author have been asserted. Thanks for listening.